Of course, I didn't know or care about any of that when I was a kid, the historical significance. But it's there. I stepped back to get a better look. It was a direct and matter-of-fact little creature, with nothing sentimental about it, and something about the neat, compact way it tucked down inside itself. Its brightness, its alert, watchful expression, made me think of pictures I'd seen of my mother when she was small, a dark, capped finch with steady eyes. It was a famous tragedy in Dutch history, my mother was saying. A huge part of the town was destroyed.
What?
The disaster at Delft that killed Fabricius. Did you hear the teacher back there telling the children about it? I had. There had been a trio of ghastly landscapes by a painter named Egbert van der Poel. Different views of the same smoldering wasteland. Burnt, ruined houses, a windmill with tattered sails, crows wheeling in smoky skies. An official-looking lady had been explaining loudly to a group of middle school kids that a gunpowder factory exploded at Delft in the 1600s, that the painter had been so haunted and obsessed by the destruction of his city that he painted it over and over. Well, Egbert was Fabricius's neighbor. He sort of lost his mind after the powder explosion. At least, that's how it looks to me. But Fabricius was killed, and his studio was destroyed, along with almost all his paintings, except this one. She seemed to be waiting for me to say something, but when I didn't, she continued. He was one of the greatest painters of his day, in one of the greatest ages of painting. Very, very famous in his time. It's sad, though, because maybe only 5 or 6 paintings survived of all his work. All the rest of it is lost. Everything he ever did. The girl and her grandfather were loitering quietly to the side, listening to my mother talk, which was a bit embarrassing. I glanced away and then, unable to resist, glanced back. They were standing very close, so close I could have reached out and touched them. She was batting and plucking at the old man's sleeve, tugging his arm to whisper something in his ear. Anyway, if you ask me, my mother was saying, this is the most extraordinary picture in the whole show. Fabricius is making clear something that he discovered all on his own, that no painter in the world knew before him, not even Rembrandt. Very softly, so softly I could barely hear her, I heard the girl whisper, "It had to live its whole life like that." I'd been wondering the same thing. The shackled foot, the chain was terrible. Her grandfather murmured some reply, but my mother, who seemed totally unaware of them even though they were right next to us, stepped back and said, "Such a mysterious picture. So simple. Really tender. Invites you to stand close, you know? All those dead pheasants back there. And then this little living creature." I allowed myself another stealthy glimpse in the girl's direction. She was standing on one leg, with her hip swung out to the side. Then, quite suddenly, she turned and looked me in the eye. And in a heart skip of confusion, I looked away. What was her name? Why wasn't she in school? I'd been trying to make out the scribbled name on the flute case, but even when I leaned in as far as I dared without being obvious, still I couldn't read the bold, spiky marker strokes. More drawn than written. Like something spray-painted on a subway car. The last name was short, only 4 or 5 letters. The first looked like R, or was it P? People die, sure, my mother was saying. But it's so heartbreaking and unnecessary how we lose things from pure carelessness. Fires, wars, the Parthenon, used as a munitions storehouse. I guess that anything we manage to save from history is a miracle. The grandfather had drifted away, a few paintings over, but she was loitering a few steps behind the girl and kept casting glances back at my mother and me. Beautiful skin, milky white, arms like carved marble. Definitely she looked athletic, though too pale to be a tennis player. Maybe she was a ballerina or a gymnast or even a high diver. Practicing late in shadowy indoor pools echoes and refractions, dark tile, plunging with arched chest and pointed toes to the bottom of the pool, a silent pow, shiny black swimsuit, bubbles foaming and streaming off her small, tense frame. Why did I obsess over people like this? Was it normal to fixate on strangers in this particular vivid, fevered way? I didn't think so. It was impossible to imagine some random passerby on the street forming quite such an interest in me. And yet, it was the main reason I'd gone in those houses with Tom. I was fascinated by strangers, wanted to know what food they ate and what dishes they ate it from, what movies they watched and what music they listened to, wanted to look under their beds and in their secret drawers and night tables and inside the pockets of their coats. Often I saw interesting-looking people on the street and thought about them restlessly for days, imagining their lives, making up stories about them on the subway or the crosstown bus. Years had passed, and I still hadn't stopped thinking about the dark-haired children in Catholic school uniforms, brother and sister, I'd seen in Grand Central, literally trying to pull their father out the door of a seedy bar by the sleeves of his suit jacket. Nor had I forgotten the frail, gypsyish girl in a wheelchair out in front of the Carlisle Hotel, talking breathlessly in Italian to the fluffy dog in her lap, while a sharp character in sunglasses, father, bodyguard, stood behind her chair, apparently conducting some sort of business deal on his phone. For years, I'd turned those strangers over in my mind, wondering who they were and what their lives were like, and I knew I would go home and wonder about this girl and her grandfather the same way. The old man had money. You could tell from how he was dressed. Why was it just the two of them? Where were they from? Maybe they were part of some big, old, complicated New York family. Music people, academics, one of those artsy West Side families that you saw up around Columbia or at Lincoln Center matinees. Or maybe, homely, civilized old creature that he was, maybe he wasn't her grandfather at all. Maybe he was a music teacher, and she was the flute prodigy he had discovered in some small town and brought to play at Carnegie Hall. "Theo," my mother said suddenly. "Did you hear me?" Her voice brought me back to myself. We were in the last room of the show. Beyond lay the exhibition shop, postcards, cash register, glossy stacks of art books, and my mother, unfortunately, had not lost track of the time. "We should see if it's still raining," she was saying. "We've still got a little while," looking at her watch, glancing past me at the exit sign. "But I think I'd better go downstairs if I'm going to try to get something for Mathilde." I noticed the girl observing my mother as she spoke, eyes gliding curiously over my mother's sleek black ponytail, her white satin trench coat cinched at the waist, and it thrilled me to see her for a moment as the girl saw her, as a stranger. Did she see how my mother's nose had the tiniest bump at the top, where she'd broken it falling out of a tree as a child? Or how the black rings around the light blue irises of my mother's eyes gave her a slightly wild quality, as of some steady-eyed hunting creature, alone on a plane? "You know," my mother looked over her shoulder, "if you don't mind, I just might run back and take another quick look at the anatomy lesson before we leave. I didn't get to see it up close, and I'm afraid I might not make it back before it comes down." She started away, shoes clacking busily, and then glanced back as if to say, "Are you coming?" This was so unexpected that for a split second I didn't know what to say. I said, recovering. "I'll meet you in the shop." "Okay," she said. "Buy me a couple of cards, will you? I'll be back in a sec." And off she hurried, before I had a chance to say a word. Heart pounding, unable to believe my luck, I watched her walking rapidly away from me in the white satin trench coat. This was it, my chance to talk to the girl. But what can I say to her? I thought furiously. What can I say? I dug my hands in my pockets, took a breath or two to compose myself, and, excitement fizzing bright in my stomach, turned to face her. But, to my consternation, she was gone. That is to say, she wasn't gone. There was her red head,
moving reluctantly, or so it seemed, across the room. Her grandpa had slipped his arm through hers and, whispering to her with great enthusiasm, was towing her away to look at some picture on the opposite wall. I could have killed him. Nervously, I glanced at the empty doorway. Then I dug my hands deeper in my pockets and, face burning, walked conspicuously across the length of the gallery. The clock was ticking. My mother would be back any second. And though I knew I didn't have the nerve to barge up and actually say something, I could at the very least get a last good look at her. Not long before, I had stayed up late with my mother and watched Citizen Kane, and I was very taken with the idea that a person might notice in passing some bewitching stranger and remember her for the rest of his life. Someday I too might be like the old man in the movie, leaning back in my chair with a far-off look in my eyes and saying, "You know, that was 60 years ago, and I never saw that girl with the red hair again. But you know what? Not a month has gone by in all that time when I haven't thought of her." I was more than halfway across the gallery when something strange happened. A museum guard ran across the open doorway of the exhibition shop beyond. He was carrying something in his arms. The girl saw it too. Her golden brown eyes met mine, a startled, quizzical look. Suddenly, another guard flew out of the museum shop. His arms were up, and he was screaming. Heads went up. Someone behind me said in an odd, flat voice, "Oh." The next instant, a tremendous, ear-splitting blast shook the room. The old man, with a blank look on his face, stumbled sideways. His outstretched arm, knotty fingers spread, is the last thing I remember seeing. At almost exactly the same moment, there was a black flash, with debris sweeping and twisting around me, and a roar of hot wind slammed into me and threw me across the room. And that was the last thing I knew for a while. 5. I don't know how long I was out. When I came to, it seemed as if I was flat on my stomach in a sandbox, on some dark playground, someplace I didn't know, a deserted neighborhood. A gang of tough, runty boys was bunched around me, kicking me in the ribs and the back of the head. My neck was twisted to the side, and the wind was knocked out of me, but that wasn't the worst of it. I had sand in my mouth. I was breathing sand. The boys muttered, audibly, "Get up, asshole. Look at him. Look at him. He don't know dick." I rolled over and threw my arms over my head, and then, with an airy, surreal jolt, saw that nobody was there. For a moment, I lay too stunned to move. Alarm bells clanged in a muffled distance, as strange as it seemed. I was under the impression that I was lying in the walled-in courtyard of some godforsaken housing project. Somebody had beaten me up pretty good. I ached all over. My ribs were sore and my head felt like someone had hit me with a lead pipe. I was working my jaw back and forth and reaching for my pockets to see if I had train fare home when it came over me abruptly that I had no clue where I was. Stiffly, I lay there, in the growing consciousness that something was badly out of joint. The light was all wrong, and so was the air, acrid and sharp, a chemical fog that burned my throat. The gum in my mouth was gritty, and when, head pounding, I rolled over to spit it out, I found myself blinking through layers of smoke at something so foreign. I stared for some moments. I was in a ragged, white cave. Swags and tatters dangled from the ceiling. The ground was tumbled and bucked up with heaps of a gray substance like moon rock, and blown about with broken glass and gravel and a hurricane of random trash, bricks and slag and papery stuff, frosted with a thin ash like first frost. High overhead, a pair of lamps beamed through the dust like off-kilter car lights in fog, cockeyed, one angled upward and the other rolled to the side and casting skewed shadows. My ears rang, and so did my body. An intensely disturbing sensation. Bones, brain, heart, all thrumming like a struck bell. Faintly from somewhere far away, the mechanical shriek of alarms rang steady and impersonal. I could hardly tell if the noise was coming from inside me or outside me. There was a strong sense of being alone, in wintry deadness. Nothing made sense in any direction. In a cascade of grit, my hand on some not quite vertical surface, I stood, wincing at the pain in my head. The tilt of the space where I was had a deep, innate wrongness. On one side, smoke and dust hung in a still, blanketed layer. On the other, a mass of shredded material slanted down in a tangle where the roof or the ceiling should have been. My jaw hurt. My face and knees were cut. My mouth was like sandpaper. Blinking around at the chaos, I saw a tennis shoe. Drifts of crumbly matter, stained dark. A twisted aluminum walking stick. I was swaying there, choked and dizzy, not knowing where to turn or what to do. When all of a sudden, I thought I heard a phone going off. For a moment, I wasn't sure. I listened, hard, and then it spieled off again, faint and draggy, a little weird. Clumsily, I grappled around in the wreckage, upending dusty kitty purses and day packs, snatching my hands back at hot things and shards of broken glass, more and more troubled by the way the rubble gave under my feet in spots and by the soft, inert lumps at the edge of my vision. Even after I became convinced I'd never heard a phone, that the ringing in my ears had played a trick on me, still I kept looking, locked into the mechanical gestures of searching with an unthinking robot intensity. Among pens, handbags, wallets, broken eyeglasses, hotel key cards, compacts and perfume spray, and prescription medications, Reutemann, Andrea, alprazolam, 0.25 milligrams. I unearthed a keychain flashlight and a non-working phone, half-charged, no bars, which I threw in a collapsible nylon shopping bag I'd found in some lady's purse. I was gasping, half-choked with plaster dust, and my head hurt so badly I could hardly see. I wanted to sit down, except there was no place to sit. Then I saw a bottle of water. My eyes reverted fast and strayed over the havoc until I saw it again, about 15 feet away, half buried in a pile of trash, just a hint of a label, familiar shade of cold case blue. With a benumbed heaviness like moving through snow, I began to slog and weave through the debris, rubbish breaking under my feet in sharp, glacial-sounding cracks. But I had not made it very far when, out of the corner of my eye, I saw movement on the ground, conspicuous in the stillness, a stirring of white on white. I stopped. Then I waded a few steps closer. It was a man, flat on his back and whitened head to toe with dust. He was so well camouflaged in the ash-powdered wreckage that it was a moment before his form came clear. Chalk on chalk, struggling to sit up like a statue knocked off his pedestal. As I drew closer, I saw that he was old and very frail, with a misshapen hunchback quality. His hair, what he had, was blown straight up from his head. The side of his face was stippled with an ugly spray of burns, and his head, above one ear, was a sticky, black horror. I had made it over to where he was when, unexpectedly fast, he shot out his dust-whitened arm and grabbed my hand. In panic, I started back, but he only clutched at me tighter, coughing and coughing, with a sick wetness. "Where?" he seemed to be saying. "Where?" He was trying to look up at me, but his head dangled heavily on his neck, and his chin lolled on his chest, so that he was forced to peer from under his brow at me like a vulture. But his eyes, in the ruined face, were intelligent and despairing. "Oh, God," I said, bending to help him. "Wait, wait." And then I stopped, not knowing what to do. His lower half lay twisted on the ground like a pile of dirty clothes. He braced himself with his arms, gamely, it seemed, lips moving and still struggling to raise himself. He reeked of burned hair, burned wool, but the lower half of his body seemed disconnected from the upper half, and he coughed and fell back in a heap. I looked around, trying to get my bearings, deranged from the crack on the head, with no sense of time, or even if it was day or night. The grandeur and desolation of the space baffled me. The high, rare loft of it, layered with gradations of smoke, and billowing with a tangled, tent-like effect where the ceiling, or the sky, ought to be. But though I had no idea where I was or why, still there was a half-remembered quality about the wreckage, a cinematic charge in the glare of the emergency lamps. On the internet, I'd seen footage of a hotel blown up in the desert, where the honeycombed rooms at the moment of collapse were frozen in just such a blast of light. Then I remembered the water. I stepped backwards, looking all around, until with a leap of my heart, I spotted the dusty flash of blue. "Look," I said, edging away. "I'm just..." The old man was watching me with a gaze at once hopeful and hopeless, like a starved dog, too weak to walk. "No, wait, I'm coming back." Like a drunk, I staggered through the rubbish, weaving and plowing, stepping high-kneed over objects, muddling through bricks and concrete and shoes and handbags, and a whole lot of charred bits I didn't want to see too closely. The bottle was three-quarters full and hot to the touch, but at the first swallow my throat took charge and I'd gulped more than half of it, plastic-tasting, dishwater warm, before I realized what I was doing, and forced myself to cap it and put it in the bag to take back to him, kneeling beside him, rocks digging into my knees. He was shivering, breaths rasping and uneven. His gaze didn't meet mine, but strayed above it, fixed fretfully on something I didn't see. I was fumbling for the water when he reached his hand to my face. Carefully, with his bony, old, flat-pad fingers, he brushed the hair from my eyes and plucked a thorn of glass from my eyebrow, and then patted me on the head.
"There, there."
His voice was very faint, very scratchy, very cordial, with a ghastly pulmonary whistle. We looked at each other for a long, strange moment that I've never forgotten, actually. Like two animals meeting at twilight, during which some clear, personable spark seemed to fly up through his eyes, and I saw the creature he really was, and he, I believe, saw me. For an instant we were wired together and humming, like two engines on the same circuit. Then he lolled back again, so limply I thought he was dead. "Here," I said, awkwardly slipping my hand under his shoulder. "That's good." I held up his head as best I could, and helped him drink from the bottle. He could only take a little, and most of it ran down his chin, again falling back. Effort too much.
"Pippa,"
he said thickly. I looked down at his burnt, reddened face, stirred by something familiar in his eyes, which were rusty and clear. I had seen him before, and I had seen the girl, too. The briefest snapshot, an autumn leaf lucidity. Rusty eyebrows, honey brown eyes. Her face was reflected in his. Where was she? He was trying to say something. Cracked lips working. He wanted to know where Pippa was, wheezing and gasping for breath. "Here," I said, agitated. "Try to lie still."
"She should take the train. It's so much faster. Unless they bring her in a car."
"Don't worry," I said, leaning closer. I wasn't worried. Someone would be in to get us shortly, I was sure of it.
"I'll wait till they come." "You're so kind."
His hand, cold, dry as powder, tightening on mine.
I haven't seen you since you were a little boy again. You were all grown up the last time we spoke. But I'm Theo,
I said, after a slightly confused pause.
Of course you are.
His gaze, like his hand clasp, was steady and kind.
And you've made the very best choice. I'm sure of it. The Mozart is so much nicer than the Gluck, don't you think?
I didn't know what to say.
It'll be easier, the two of you. They're so hard on you children in the auditions.
Coughing, lips slick with blood, thick and red.
No second chances.
Listen. It felt wrong, letting him think I was someone else.
Oh, but you play it so beautifully, my dear. The pair of you. The G major. It keeps running through my mind. Lightly, lightly. Touch and go.
Humming a few shapeless notes. A song. It was a song.
And I must have told you how I went for piano lessons at the old Armenian ladies. There was a green lizard that lived in the palm tree. Green, like a candy drop. I loved to watch for him, flashing on the windowsill. Fairy lights in the garden. Du Pays Saint. 20 minutes to walk it, but it seemed like miles.
He faded for a minute. I could feel his intelligence drifting away from me, spinning out of sight like a leaf on a brook. Then it washed back, and there he was again.
And you? How old are you now?
13.
At the Lycée Français?
No. My school's on the west side.
And just as well, I should think, all these French classes. Too many vocabulary words for a child. Nom et pronom. Species and phylum. It's only a form of insect collecting.
Sorry?
They always spoke French at Groppies. Remember Groppies? With the striped umbrella and the pistachio ices.
Striped umbrella. It was hard to think through my headache. My glance wandered to the long gash in his scalp, clotted and dark like an axe wound. More and more I was becoming aware of dreadful body-like shapes slumped in the debris, dark hulks not clearly seen, pressing in silently all around us, dark everywhere, and the rag-doll bodies, and yet it was a darkness you could drift away upon, something sleepy about it. Frothy wake churned and vanished on a cold, black ocean. Suddenly something was very wrong. He was awake, shaking me, hands flapping. He wanted something. He tried to press himself up on a whistling in-breath.
What is it?
I said, shaking myself alert. He was gasping, agitated, tugging at my arm. Fearfully, I sat up and looked around, expecting to see some fresh danger rolling in. Loose wires, a fire, the ceiling about to collapse. Grabbing my hand, squeezing it tight.
Not there,
he managed to say.
What?
Don't leave it. No.
He was looking past me, trying to point at something.
Take it away from there.
Please, lie down.
No, they mustn't see it.
He was frantic, gripping my arm now, trying to pull himself up.
They've stolen the rugs. They'll take it to the customs shed.
He was, I saw, pointing over at a dusty rectangle of board, virtually invisible in the broken beams and rubbish, smaller than my laptop computer at home.
That?
I said, looking closer. It was blobbed with drips of wax and pasted with an irregular patchwork of crumbling labels.
That's what you want?
I beg of you.
Eyes squeezed tight. He was upset, coughing so hard he could barely speak. I reached out and picked the board up by the edges. It felt surprisingly heavy for something so small. A long splinter of broken frame clung to one corner. Drawing my sleeve across the dusty surface, tiny yellow bird, faint beneath a veil of white dust. The anatomy lesson was in the same book, actually, but it used to scare the pants off me. Right, I answered drowsily. I turned, painting in hand, to show it to her, and then realized she wasn't there. Or she was there, and she wasn't. Part of her was there, but it was invisible. The invisible part was the important part. This was something I had never understood before. But when I tried to say this out loud, the words came out in a muddle, and I realized with a cold slap that I was wrong. Both parts had to be together. You couldn't have one part without the other. I rubbed my arm across my forehead and tried to blink the grit from my eyes, and, with a massive effort, like lifting a weight much too heavy for me, tried to shift my mind where I knew it needed to be. Where was my mother? For a moment, there had been three of us, and one of these, I was pretty sure, had been her. But now there were only two. Behind me, the old man had begun to cough and shudder again, with an uncontrollable urgency, trying to speak. Reaching back, I tried to hand the picture over to him. Here, I said, and then, to my mother, in the spot where she had seemed to be, I'll be back in a minute. But the painting wasn't what he wanted. Fretfully, he pushed it back at me, babbling something. The right side of his head was such a sticky drench of blood, I could hardly see his ear. What? I said, mind still on my mother. Where was she? Sorry?
Take it.
Look, I'll be back. I have to... I couldn't get it out. Not quite. But my mother wanted me to go home immediately. I was supposed to meet her there. That was the one thing she had made very clear.
Take it with you.
Pressing it on me.
Go.
He was trying to sit up. His eyes were bright and wild. His agitation frightened me.
They took all the light bulbs. They've smashed up half the houses in the street.
A drip of blood ran down his chin.
Please,
I said, hands flustering, afraid to touch him.
Please lie down.
He shook his head and tried to say something, but the effort broke him down, hacking with a wet, miserable sound. When he wiped his mouth, I saw a bright stripe of blood on the back of his hand.
Somebody's coming.
Not sure I believed it, not knowing what else to say. He looked straight into my face, searching for some flicker of understanding, and when he didn't find it, he clawed to sit up again.
Fire!
He said in a gargling voice.
The villa in Mahadi. Una, two, they'll do.
He broke off coughing again, red-tinged froth bubbling at his nostrils. In the midst of all that unreality, cairns and broken monoliths, I had a dreamlike sense of having failed him, as if I'd botched some vital fairy tale task through clumsiness and ignorance. Though there wasn't any visible fire anywhere in that tumble of stone, I crawled over and put the painting in the nylon shopping bag, just to get it out of his sight. It was upsetting him so.
Don't worry,
I said.
I'll...
He had calmed down. He put a hand on my wrist, eyes steady and bright, and a chill wind of unreason blew over me. I had done what I was supposed to do. Everything was going to be all right. As I was basking in the comfort of this notion, he squeezed my hand reassuringly, as if I had spoken the thought aloud. We'll get away from here, he said.
I know.
Wrap it in newspapers, then pack it at the very bottom of the trunk, my dear, with the other curiosities.
Relieved that he'd calmed down, exhausted with my headache, all memory of my mother faded to a moth-like flicker, I settled down beside him and closed my eyes, feeling oddly comfortable and safe. Absent. Dreamy. He was rambling a bit under his breath. Foreign names, sums and numbers. A few French words, but mostly English. A man was coming to look at the furniture. Abdu was in trouble for throwing stones. And yet it all made sense somehow. and I saw the palmy garden and the piano and the green lizard on the tree trunk as if they were pages in a photograph album. "Will you be all right getting home by yourself, my dear?" I remember him asking at one point.
"Of course."
I was lying on the floor beside him, my head on a level with his rickety old breastbone, so that I could hear every catch and wheeze in his breath.
"I take the train by myself every day."
"And where did you say you are living now?"
His hand on my head, very gently, the way you'd rest your hand on the head of a dog you liked.
"East 57th Street."
"Oh, yes, near Le Veau d'Or."
"Well, a few blocks." Le Veau d'Or was a restaurant where my mother had liked to go back when we had money. I had eaten my first escargot there and tasted my first sip of Marc de Bourgogne from her glass.
"Towards Park, you say?"
"No, closer to the river."
"Close enough, my dear. Meringue and caviar. How I loved this city the first time I saw it. Still, it's not the same, is it? I miss it all terribly, don't you? The balcony and the
garden."
I turned to look at him. Perfumes and melodies. In my swamp of confusion, it had come to seem that he was a close friend or family member I'd forgotten about. Some long-lost relative of my mother's.
"Oh, your mother, the darling. I'll never forget the first time she came to play. She was the prettiest little girl I ever saw."
How had he known I was thinking about her? I started to ask him, but he was asleep. His eyes were closed, but his breath was fast and hoarse, like he was running from something. I was fading out myself. Ears ringing, inane buzz, and a metallic taste in my mouth like at the dentist's. And I might have drifted back into unconsciousness and stayed there had he not at some point shaken me hard, so I awoke with a buck of panic. He was mumbling and tugging at his index finger. He'd taken his ring off. A heavy gold ring with a carved stone. He was trying to give it to me.
"Here, I don't want that,"
I said, shying away.
"What are you doing that for?"
But he pressed it into my palm. His breath was bubbled and ugly.
"Hobart and Blackwell,"
he said, in a voice like he was drowning from the inside out.
"Ring the green bell."
"Green bell,"
I repeated, uncertainly. He lolled his head back and forth, punch drunk, lips quivering. His eyes were unfocused. When they slid over me without seeing me, they gave me a shiver.
"Tell Hobie to get out of this store,"
he said thickly. In disbelief, I watched the blood trickling bright from the corner of his mouth. He'd loosened his tie by yanking at it.
"Here,"
I said, reaching over to help, but he batted my hands away.
"He's got to close the register and get out,"
he rasped.
"His father's sending some guys to beat him up."
His eyes rolled up. His eyelids fluttered. Then he sank down into himself, flat and collapsed, looking like all the air was out of him. 30 seconds, 40, like a heap of old clothes, but then so harshly I flinched. His chest swelled on a bellows-like rasp, and he coughed a percussive gout of blood that spewed all over me. As best he could, he hitched himself up on his elbows, and for 30 seconds or so he panted like a dog, chest pumping frantically, up and down, his eyes fixed on something I couldn't see, and all the time gripping my hand like maybe if he held on tight enough, he'd be okay.
"Are you all right?"
I said, frantic, close to tears.
"Can you hear me?"
As he grappled and thrashed, a fish out of water, I held his head up, or tried to, not knowing how, afraid of hurting him. As all the time he clutched my hand like he was dangling off a building and about to fall. Each breath was an isolated, gargling heave, a heavy stone lifted with terrible effort and dropped again and again to the ground. At one point he looked at me directly, blood welling in his mouth, and seemed to say something, but the words were only a burble down his chin. Then, to my intense relief, he grew calmer, quieter, his grasp on my hand loosening, melting, a sense of sinking and spinning away almost like he was floating on his back away from me, on water. "Better?" I asked, and then, carefully, I dripped a bit of water on his mouth. His lips worked, I saw them moving, and then, on my knees, like a servant boy in a story, I wiped some of the blood off his face with the paisley square from his pocket. As he drifted, cruelly, by degrees and latitudes, into stillness, I rocked back on my heels and looked hard into his wrecked face. "Hello," I said. One papery eyelid, half shut, twitched, a blue-veined tick. "If you can hear me, squeeze my hand." But his hand in mine was limp. I sat there and looked at him, not knowing what to do. It was time to go, well past time. My mother had made that perfectly clear, and yet I could see no path out of the space where I was, and in fact in some ways it was hard to imagine being anywhere else in the world, that there was another world outside that one. It was like I'd never had another life at all. "Can you hear me?" I asked him, one last time, bending close and putting my ear to his bloodied mouth. But there was nothing. 6. Not wanting to disturb him, in case he was only resting, I was as quiet as I could be, standing up. I hurt all over. For some moments I stood looking down at him, wiping my hands on my school jacket. His blood was all over me, my hands were slick with it. And then I looked at the moonscape of rubble, trying to orient myself and figure the best way to go. When, with difficulty, I made my way into the center of the space, or what seemed like the center of the space, I saw that one door was obscured by rags of hanging debris, and I turned and began to work in the other direction. There, the lintel had fallen, dumping a pile of brick almost as tall as I was, and leaving a smoky space at the top big enough to drive a car through. Laboriously, I began to climb and scramble for it, over and around the chunks of concrete. But I had not got very far when I realized that I was going to have to go the other way. Faint traces of fire licked down the far walls of what had been the exhibition shop, spitting and sparkling in the dim, some of it well below the level where the floor should have been. I didn't like the looks of the other door, foam tile stained red, the toe of a man's shoe protruding from a pile of gravel. But at least most of the material blocking the door wasn't very solid. Blundering back through, ducking some wires that sparked from the ceiling, I hoisted the bag over my shoulder and took a deep breath and plunged into the wreckage headlong. Immediately I was choked by dust and a sharp chemical smell. Coughing, praying there were no more live wires hanging loose, I padded and groped in the dark as all sorts of loose debris began to patter and shower down in my eyes. Gravel, crumbs of plaster, shreds and chunks of God knows what. Some of the building material was light, and some of it was not. The further I worked in, the darker it got and the hotter. Every so often, my way dwindled or closed up unexpectedly, and in my ears a roaring crowd noise. I wasn't sure where it came from. I had to squeeze around things. Sometimes I walked, sometimes I crawled. Bodies in the wreckage more sensed than seen, a disturbing soft pressure that gave under my weight, but worse than this, the smell. Burnt cloth, burnt hair and flesh, and the tang of fresh blood, copper, and tin, and salt. My hands were cut, and so were my knees. I ducked under things and went around things, feeling my way as I went, edging with my hip along the side of some sort of long lathe or beam, until I found my way blocked by a solid mass that felt like a wall. With difficulty, The spot was narrow. I worked my way around so I could reach into the bag for a light. I wanted the keychain light, at the bottom, under the picture, but my fingers closed on the phone. I switched it on, and almost immediately dropped it, because in the glow I'd caught sight of a man's hand protruding between two chunks of concrete. Even in my terror, I remember feeling grateful that it was only a hand, although the fingers had a meaty, dark, swollen look I've never been able to forget. Every now and then I still start back in fear when some beggar on the street thrusts out to me such a hand, bloated and grimed with black around the nails. There was still the flashlight, but I wanted the phone. It cast a weak glimmer up into the cavity where I was, but just as I recovered myself enough to stoop for it, the screen went dark. An acid green afterburn floated before me in the blackness. I got down on my knees and crawled around in the dark, grappling with both hands in rocks and glass, determined to find it. I thought I knew where it was, or about where it was, and I kept looking for it probably longer than I should have. And it was when I'd given up hope and tried to get up again that I realized I'd crawled into a low spot where it was impossible to stand, with some solid surface about 3 inches above my head. Turning around didn't work. Going backwards didn't work. So I decided to crawl forward, hoping that things would open up, and soon found myself inching along painfully with a smashed, desperate feeling, and my head turned sharply to one side. When I was about 4, I'd gotten partially stuck inside a Murphy bed in our old apartment on 7th Avenue, which sounds like a humorous predicament, but wasn't really. I think I would have suffocated if Alameda, our housekeeper back then, hadn't heard my muffled cries and pulled me out. Trying to maneuver in that airless space was somewhat the same, only worse, with glass, hot metal, the stink of burned clothes, and an occasional soft something pressing in on me that I didn't want to think about. Debris was pattering down on me heavily from above. My throat was filling with dust, and I was coughing hard and starting to panic when I realized I could see, just barely, the rough texture of the broken bricks that surrounded me. Light, the faintest gleam imaginable, crept in subtly from the left, about 6 inches from floor level. I ducked lower and found myself looking over into the dim terrazzo floor of the gallery beyond. A disorderly pile of what looked like rescue equipment, ropes, axes, crowbars, an oxygen tank that said FDNY, lay harum-scarum on the floor. "Hello?" I called, not waiting for an answer, dropping to wriggle through the hole as fast as I could. The space was narrow. If I'd been a few years older or a few pounds heavier, I might not have got through. Partway, though, my bag caught on something, and for a moment I thought I might have to slip free of it, painting or no painting, like a lizard shedding its tail. But when I gave it one last pull, it finally broke free with a shower of crumbled plaster. Above me was a beam of some sort, which looked like it was holding up a lot of heavy building material. And as I twisted and squirmed beneath it, I was lightheaded with fear that it would slip and cut me in two, until I saw that somebody had stabilized it with a jack. Once clear, I climbed to my feet, watery and stunned with relief. "Hello?" I called again, wondering why there was so much equipment around and not a fireman in sight. The gallery was dim, but mostly undamaged, with gauzy layers of smoke that thickened the higher they rose. But you could tell that a tremendous force of some sort had blown through the room just from the lights and the security cameras, which were knocked askew and facing the ceiling. I was so happy to be out in open space again that it was a moment or so before I realized the strangeness of being the only person standing up in a room full of people. Everybody else was lying down except me. There were at least a dozen people on the floor, not all of them intact. They had the appearance of being dropped from a great height. 3 or 4 of the bodies were partially covered with firemen's coats, feet sticking out. Others sprawled glaringly in the open, amidst explosive stains. The splashes and bursts carried a violence like big blood sneezes, an hysterical sense of movement in the stillness. I remember particularly a middle-aged lady in a blood-spattered blouse that had a pattern of Fabergé eggs on it, like a blouse she might have bought in the museum gift shop, actually. Her eyes, lined with black makeup, stared blankly at the ceiling, and her tan was obviously sprayed on since her skin had a healthy apricot glow, even though the top of her head was missing. Dim oils, dulled gilt. Taking tiny steps, I walked out into the middle of the room, swaying, slightly off balance. I could hear my own breath rasping in and out, and there was a strange shallowness in the sound, a nightmare lightness. I didn't want to look, and yet I had to. A small Asian man, pathetic in his tan windbreaker, curled in a bellying pool of blood. A guard, his uniform the most recognizable thing about him, his face was burned so badly, with an arm twisted behind his back and a vicious spray where his leg should have been. But the main thing, the important thing, none of the lying down people was her. I made myself look at them all, each separately, one by one, even when I couldn't force myself to look at their faces. I knew my mother's feet, her clothes, her two-tone black and white shoes. And long after, I was sure of it, I made myself stand in their midst, folded deep inside myself, like a sick pigeon with its eyes closed. In the gallery beyond, more dead. Three dead. Fat Argyle vest man. Cankered old lady. A milky duckling of a little girl. Red abrasion at her temple, but otherwise hardly a mark on her. But then, there were no more. I walked through several galleries littered with equipment, but despite the bloodstains on the floor, there were no dead at all. And when I walked into the far-seeming gallery where she'd been, where she'd gone, the gallery with the anatomy lesson, eyes closed tight, wishing hard, there were only the same stretchers and equipment, and there, as I walked through in the oddly screaming silence, the only two eyes on me were the same two puzzled Dutchmen who had stared at my mother and me from the wall. What are you doing here? Then something snapped. I don't even remember how it happened. I was just in a different place and running, running through rooms that were empty except for a haze of smoke that made the grandeur seem insubstantial and unreal. Earlier, the galleries had seemed fairly straightforward, a meandering but logical sequence where all tributaries flowed into the gift shop. But coming back through them fast and in the opposite direction, I realized that the path wasn't straight at all, and over I turned into blank walls and veered into dead-end rooms. Doors and entrances weren't where I expected them to be. Freestanding plinths loomed out of nowhere. Swinging around a corner a little too sharply, I almost ran headlong into a gang of Franz Hals guardsmen. Big, rough, ruddy-cheeked guys, bleary from too much beer, like New York City cops at a costume party. Coldly, they stared me down with hard, humorous eyes as I recovered, backed off, and began to run again. Even on a good day, I sometimes got turned around in the museum, wandering aimlessly in galleries of oceanic art, totems, and dugout canoes, and sometimes I had to go up and ask a guard to point the way out. The painting galleries were especially confusing, since they were rearranged so often. And as I ran around in the empty halls, in the ghostly half-light, I was growing more and more frightened. I thought I knew my way to the main staircase. But soon after I was out of the special exhibitions galleries, things started looking unfamiliar, and after a minute or two running lightheaded through turns I was no longer quite sure of, I realized I was thoroughly lost. Somehow I'd gone right through the Italian masterworks, crucified Christs and astonished saints, serpents and embattled angels, ending up in England, 18th century, a part of the museum I had seldom been in before and did not know at all. Long, elegant lines of sight stretched out before me, maze-like halls which had the feel of a haunted mansion, periwigged lords, cool Gainsborough beauties, gazing superciliously down at my distress. The baronial perspectives were infuriating, since they didn't seem to lead to the staircase or any of the main corridors, but only to other stately baronial galleries exactly like them. and I was close to tears when suddenly I saw an inconspicuous door in the side of the gallery wall. You had to look twice to see it, this door. It was painted the same color as the gallery walls, the kind of door which, in normal circumstances, looked like it would be kept locked. The only reason it had caught my attention was because it wasn't completely closed. The left side wasn't flush with the wall, whether because it hadn't caught properly or the lock wasn't working because the electricity was out, I didn't know. Still, it was not easy to get open. It was heavy, steel, and I had to pull with all my strength. Suddenly, with a pneumatic gasp, it gave. So capriciously, I stumbled. Squeezing through, I found myself in a dark office hallway under a much lower ceiling. The emergency lights were much weaker than in the main gallery, and it took my eyes a moment to adjust. The hallway seemed to stretch for miles. Fearfully, I crept along, peering into the offices where the doors happened to stand ajar. Cameron Geisler, Registrar. Miyako Fujita, Assistant Registrar. Drawers were open and chairs were pushed away from desks. In the doorway of one office, a woman's high-heeled shoe lay on its side. The air of abandonment was unspeakably eerie. It seemed that far in the distance I could hear police sirens, maybe even walkie-talkies and dogs, but my ears were ringing so hard from the explosion that I thought I might well be hearing things. It was starting to unnerve me more and more that I had seen no firemen, no cops, no security guards. In fact, not a single living soul. It wasn't dark enough for the keychain flashlight in the staff-only area, but neither was there nearly enough light for me to see well. I was in some sort of records or storage area. The offices were lined with filing cabinets floor to ceiling, metal shelves with plastic mailroom crates and cardboard boxes. The narrow corridor made me feel edgy, closed in, and my footsteps echoed so crazily that once or twice I stopped and turned around to see if somebody was coming down the hall after me. "Hello?" I said, tentatively, glancing into some of the rooms as I passed. Some of the offices were modern and spare. Others were crowded and dirty-looking, with untidy stacks of paper and books. Florence Klauner, Department of Musical Instruments. Maurice Arabi Roussel, Islamic Art. Vittoria Gabetti, Textiles. I passed a cavernous dark room with a long workshop table, where mismatched scraps of cloth were laid out like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. In the back of the room was a jumble of rolling garment racks with lots of plastic garment bags hanging off them, like racks by the service elevators at Bendel's or Bergdorf's. At the T-junction, I looked this way and that, not knowing which way to turn. I smelled floor wax, turpentine, and chemicals, a tang of smoke. Offices and workshops stretched out to infinity in all directions, a contained, geometrical network, fixed and featureless. To my left, light flickered from a ceiling fixture. It hummed and caught in a staticky fit, and in the trembling glow, I saw a drinking fountain down the hall. I ran for it, so fast my feet almost slid out from underneath me, and gulped with my mouth pressed against the spigot. So much cold water, so fast that a spike of pain slid into my temple. Hiccuping, I rinsed the blood from my hands and splashed water in my sore eyes. Tiny splinters of glass, almost invisible, tinkled to the steel tray of the fountain, glistening like needles of ice. I leaned against the wall. The overhead fluorescence, vibrating, spitting on and off, made me feel queasy. With effort, I pulled myself up again. On I walked, wobbling a bit in the unstable flicker. Things were looking decidedly more industrial in this direction. Wooden pallets, a flatbed pushcart, a sense of crated objects being moved and stored. I passed another junction, where a slick, shadowy passageway receded into darkness, and I was just about to walk past it and keep going, when I saw a red glow at the end of it said, "Exit." I tripped. I fell over my feet. I got up again, still hiccuping, and ran down the endless hall. Down at the end of the corridor was a door with a metal bar, like the security doors at my school. It pushed open with a bark. Down a dark stairwell I ran, 12 steps, a turn at the landing, then 12 steps to the bottom, my fingertips skimming on the metal rail, shoes clattering and echoing so crazily that and it sounded like half a dozen people were running with me. At the foot of the steps was a gray institutional corridor with another barred door. I threw myself against it, pushed it open with both hands, and was slapped hard in the face by rain and the deafening wail of sirens. I think I might have screamed out loud. I was